This podcast is brought to you by BetRivers. Download the BetRivers app from the App Store or Google Play Store. Must be 21. Available in Ohio only. Void where prohibited. Terms and conditions apply. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Sports gaming is provided in partnership with Dayton Real Estate Ventures, LLC, DBA, Hollywood Gaming at Dayton Raceway.
You're listening to the Danny Mac Podcast on the BetRivers Network.
Welcome back to the Danny Mac Podcast on the Bet Rivers Podcast Network. Hope you had a great weekend. Hope you cashed some winning tickets. I kept my money in my pocket after Friday night's big win because nothing says it's tourney time like betting on a team that calls itself the Antelopes. And that's what I did. And then I kept my money in my pocket after Grand Canyon took care of business. Bryce Drew of Northwest Indiana, way to bring it home. The calendar, sometimes I dictate... It's calendar dictates I talk about things other than football, and it's not the NCAA tournament. If Illinois goes to the Final Four, I'll do it. But right now, just to the Sweet 16, baseball season opens this week, and former Cubs right-hander Ryan Dempster, who you catch on Marquee and on MLB Network with Intentional Talk, is nice enough to give me some time today. Demp, welcome to the season, and thanks for the time. How you feeling today, man?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me. I was doing better on Friday night after the bracket started, and then I got roughed up over the weekend a little bit, so we'll get through it.
Are you done? Is it tear them up already?
No, I'm not done because I only did two brackets. It's a family pool, but both of them, I have all four Final Four teams in both brackets, so I'm not done. It's going to be some work need to be done in there.
We'll get to where the Cubs are on Bet Rivers in just a little bit. Widen the focus just a little bit on Major League Baseball right now before we get to the locals. With the pitch clock last year, games are much shorter and viewership is way up. What changes has baseball made that really have agreed with you now that you've had a chance to have them settle in a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I love the fact of the pitch timer. That was first and foremost. When this was announced and people were like, oh, and pitchers were complaining, I think it just promotes action, which obviously we've seen. And I say it this way, too. We're now seeing the best hitters in the world. Obviously, the pitchers have this, you know, they're always going to be a better percentage that the pitchers are going to get the outcome, right? Like a Hall of Famer succeeds 30% of the time as a hitter. But what we transitioned into in that Moneyball era, kind of getting on base and valuing getting on base over sometimes production, it was skewed as that's a productive value, which I understand, on base percentage. But we're now seeing the best hitters in the world swing the bat. It just the way it is. There's no more lulls. It's like, and because of that, we saw offense go up almost a run per game. The games are moving quicker, and now it's this exciting thing instead of like, oh man, here we go. Like, it's just dragging on. And to me, that single-handedly, that rule alone, like, changed it all. Sure, the bigger bases by a little bit promotes the stolen base and guys going for it, and that's awesome. But just having it so that we're not taking forever. And even like from a hitter's perspective, those guys now, I think just psychologically, they get in the box and they're ready to go. They're ready to hit. And it's just, it is, it's more exciting. I mean, the numbers don't lie, right? If we're going to play the analytical world and it feeds us on the back end of it too, and the numbers prove that it's benefiting the game of baseball, then that's great. And I love it. And I could watch baseball, Danny, man, I could watch it forever. I don't care if it's 18 innings. I care when I can go get a beer and a hot dog, use the bathroom, have a conversation, and then come sit back in my seat and go, what happened? And they go, nothing. Like, yeah, I'm done with that, man. Let's have action. Let's go.
You know, you had four consecutive seasons with the Cubs where you logged 200 or more innings, and the last of which I think 106 or 206-ish innings – placed you 34th in baseball that season. Today, or last year, that would have been fourth in Major League Baseball. There were only four guys to eclipse 200 innings. This bullpenning era, tell me how that's been good for baseball.
Uh, um, how has that been good for baseball? I guess, you know, you're seeing, you know, elite. I don't believe it's been good for baseball, to be honest with you. I think that on a macro level, all statistics are really great. But what happens is each game is individual, and even more so, each at bat is even more micro. So as we dive into the micro statistics, they're determining factors, you know, sometimes they don't play. Like sometimes when I was pitching, I could get through a lineup five or six times. And then sometimes when I was pitching, I was wondering what took the manager so long to get out there and pull me out of the game. You know, like it can go both ways. It's like sometimes you just don't have it that day, and other days you can. And what's changed is the philosophy of the starting pitcher pitching to go through a lineup three or four times. That is not taught anymore. It is how do we get the first hitter out of the game? How do we get him out? Where do we go to the weakness? What is the spin that we're going to throw him? Where is the place that we're trying to attack? When I was coming up and when a lot of guys were pitching, and you still see guys around the league, they'll do this, the elite ones will, is I'm going to try and make you hit a fastball down and away. You know, because A, it's an executed fastball in the right location is the hardest pitch to hit. So if I can do that and I get you out on one or two pitches and all you've seen is my fastball, I still have a fastball to other quadrants to get you out on. I still have breaking balls. I still have a changeup. I still have multiple methods to get you out. Now we call it like kitchen sinking. It's like unload everything. I'll watch a pitcher start the game. He'll throw a fastball down and away. Then he'll go a breaking ball. Then he'll throw a changeup. Then he'll go a fastball up and in. Well, no wonder he can't get the guy out the third time through the lineup. The guy's already seen everything, and he knows exactly what he's got. So I think that shift, and then just the relievers are become disposable. It's a guy pitches well for, you know, a couple weeks, and then he's maybe quote-unquote fatigued because he's thrown multiple innings or he's thrown back-to-back-to-back days. They ship him out. They bring another kid up who's throwing 95 to 100, and it's just this thing that goes like this. I would love to see – you know, the shift, the paradigm go back towards the starting pitcher going longer into games. I honestly don't know if Major League Baseball wants that. Like, I don't think front offices want that. Imagine every team, I'm going to ask you this. Imagine every team had a guy on their team that was throwing 200 innings. You know what you'd have to pay every one of those guys?
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly what it is. It's bottom line. And I'm with you. I don't think it's been good for the game. I saw Max Scherzer get lifted from a playoff game 2 years ago in the third freaking inning. He wasn't hurt. It's Max Scherzer. So he walked two guys. Let him find a way to wiggle his way out of that. But there have been some good things, and the game is more exciting. And Shohei Ohtani has brought a lot of excitement and recently a lot of interest to baseball. I couldn't care less about what his translator does at the window. I hope this thing goes away quickly and he can get on with his life. I had the idea a few years ago of making Carlos Zambrano an American League player and letting him be a designated hitter. And people told me, Demp, I was nuts. He could have done what Ohtani has been doing. I don't know if he'd hit 50 homers, but hell, if you got him 400 at bats, he'd hit a shitload of them.
Yep. I am so far with you, and I'm with you on multiple angles on this. One, you know, what you talked about off the top there, the Ohtani, I think we're seeing a clear case of, you know, the pedestal. Let's knock it off, right? We can't fathom a guy making this much money, so we got to find something. If he had unpaid parking tickets, we'd bring him down for because of that. Like now, if there's other stuff that comes up later, then that is what it is. But I'm not going to go around searching for something until it all comes out. But so, and I love what he's done for the game of baseball and promoted the two-way player. I think it's so incredible. And you hit the nail on the head. People ask me, who do I think could have been Shohei Ohtani at some point during my career? Like Mike Hampton could hit and pitch, but he was a really good pitcher. And at times in his career, you know, he dominated, but he wasn't this dominating 100-mile-an-hour force. And he could hit, but he wasn't putting up massive, you know, 450 foot homers. Carlos Zambrano, still to this day, and I watched Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa in 1998 put on two of the most unbelievable batting practice spectacles you'd ever see. People did not go in. They waited outside to watch these guys. Carlos Zambrano, still to this day, on an afternoon at Wrigley Field, put on the best batting practice I've ever seen. He hit a ball. Now imagine this. He hit a ball from the left side, okay, into straightaway center field, into the upper deck. And then on the next pitch off of Larry Rothschild, who was throwing batting practice, turned around on the right side and put another one in the upper deck in straightaway center field. People don't go out there into straightaway center field up above the batter's eye. This guy, I watched him get eight straight hits in the big leagues and at bats. I watched him sit there and sit on a Wade Miller curveball and take it deep. Like he, and this is over a course of, you know, what's he getting in a year? 60 at bats. Like if you gave him the same training regimen where it was like you're hitting every day, you're in the lineup every day, now you're seeing big league hitting, 30 homers, no doubt. 40, maybe. I think that this guy was, you know, probably the best hitting pitcher that I was around, and he could absolutely rake. And the size of him, he just touched baseballs. He'd always say to me, he goes, Ryan, why do you lunge at the baseball? Just stay back and just, you know, just hit it. And I'm like, bro, I don't got your power, man. You can break a bat over your knee. I don't got that, man. I got to go get it.
An exciting player. And man, you never knew what was going to happen. I don't know what Michael Barrett was thinking, trying to rectify the issue right after it happened. Were you within earshot of that clubhouse? I guess you'd call it a tussle. I heard it ended quickly.
Yeah, I was in the locker room when it all happened, because I saw Barrett leave and go up there. And I thank, still to this day, I thank my lucky stars for Ivan De Jesus, our coach, because A, he was strong enough and he spoke enough Spanish to calm Big Z down in that situation. But I'll give kudos to Michael Barrett after he peeled himself out of the floor of the locker that he got pounded into. He stood up and he looked like Martin Short in pure luck. His, you know, face was swollen up, and he just said, Ryan, just let me just go talk to him. I just would like to go talk to him. And I said, Mike, I don't think that this is a good time to be talking to Big Z right now. I mean, he just flipped the table over like he was Baby Huey. Just, whew, you know, this thing just tumbled over. So, yeah, it was, and I mean, that's the kind of, you know, strength this guy had. He could have been a professional athlete. I watched him dunk a basketball barefoot, standing underneath the hoop, just jumping up with two hands and dunk it. I watched him sit there and take passes from Jeff Zamarja. He could have been Gronk, a world-class tight end. I don't know about ice skating, but if I would have worked with him a little bit and brought the Canadian out in him, he probably could have done that too. Who knows? I mean, he was a phenomenal athlete, you know, and really like a Shohei before his time.
Speaking of Canadians, and I almost forgot this. I might not have remembered it. So one of my viewers on YouTube noticed I'm sporting the mullet of late. The locks are getting kind of long. It's a tribute to the 50th anniversary of Rush's debut album. The Canadian power trio launched on the Mercury label in March of 74. You got to be a Rush guy growing up. I know it's the other side of the country from Toronto where they're from, but you had to be a Rush guy as a kid, right?
Yeah, I was, you know, my dad was not a huge Rush guy. He was a Guess Who. That was more of the, he was from Winnipeg himself. So it was like, you know, that was more of who we got to. And we were more of a country household. But that being said, I think it's kind of impossible to not grow up with admiration for them. I mean, they're, you know, Canada's probably biggest rock band ever. And, you know, you go down the list of all the great songs. And then for me, you know, I actually started to morph into more of a Rush fan as I got into baseball and into professional baseball, because Geddy Lee is such a huge baseball fan. I mean, we just recently saw his baseball collection that he was, you know, auctioning off. And this guy's avid. Larry Walker and him, good friends. He's good friends with Randy Johnson. Randy's shot with his camera a ton of Rush concerts. So they're legends, man. They, what they were able to do, and, you know, and kind of an era that they were in, they're pioneers in the, you know, synthesized world, and just, you know, awesome, awesome tracks that, you know, a lot of guys, you still hear them today all the time.
Yeah, when I took my 13-year-old son, or I'm sorry, it was in 2013. He just graduated high school. He's 30 now, almost 30. He's a drummer. And yeah. when a couple of members of the Blackhawks who had just won the cup came out on stage with the cup, and the members of Rush, Getty took off his base and he wanted a picture with Daniel Carcillo. I mean, Neil came off the drive. It was so cool to see that. It's like merging worlds, rock and roll and hockey. And it's cool that Canada has so much pride for both.
And, yeah, no doubt.
I don't know. You grew up close to Vancouver, though. That's pretty cosmopolitan.
Yeah, very cosmopolitan. I'm trying to think of big Vancouver bands that we had. There wasn't a lot of them. Most of the good music came from, you know, out east, like, you know, the Tragically Hip were Kingston, Ontario. And, you know, like I said, the Guess Who. And you had, you know, these bands that were from more the eastern part. You know, we had a little bit of taste. Nickelback was out in Vancouver. They actually were posted up on, I believe there's an interesting story, and this could be fact checked. I don't know. But I think that during college, Nickelback was renting a house, which then they were sub renting out, and in UBC area, and they had a bunch of you know, well known parties at the time there at the place that they were putting together. So yeah, we didn't quite have it as much. So our love for music was what your parents listened to, but also, you know, usually a Canucks game. That's what we were going with. Yeah.
I heard you recently got an opportunity to perform with Eddie Vedder at the Chris Chelios jersey retirement ceremony.
Yeah, you know, it's it was my second time up on stage with Ed, which was a blast. And, you know, to do that song on that special magical evening at the United Center with Chelios' jersey retirement and the Kane overtime winner. And I'm like, and then why not just get up here and sing with Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Eddie Vedder and an amazing band, and, you know, doing a little bit of the band themselves. We sang The Weight, which was a blast. And yeah, there's something special, you know, when you're sitting there. I don't get intimidated by a lot of things, but when you're on stage with somebody with that much presence, but he made it so easy for us. I remember the first time was at Innings Festival down in Arizona, and he was doing Hard Sun to end the show, and he brought out myself, Joe Madden, Sean Casey, Chelios came out, David Ross. We had Johnny Gomes out there with us, a bunch of guys. And at the end of Hard Sun, when he's just ripping into the guitar and he's just, you know, we're supposed to be doing the chorus, you know, and I'm looking over and there's veins bursting in his neck. You know, he's been jamming for an hour and 40 minutes to this crowd of 20-something thousand people. And he's looking at me like, let's go, man. Come on, let's turn it up. And I'm like, I didn't know what I'd do. I almost locked up. It was so intimidating, and you just have a great appreciation for any musician does up there, but let alone a true rock star like that. I mean, he's owning it, you know. He's got everybody eating out of the palm of his hands, and rightfully so, because there's some passion in there. I loved it.
Yeah, I imagine that would have been a cool experience. It was just cool watching a lot of that stuff just on my 60-inch. It was fun. Let's get to the Cubs. And we've got them at Bet Rivers at 85.5 wins this year. I think that's a little bit ambitious to go over. They won 83 games last year. And while Marcus Stroman did fade down the stretch, he still was a huge part of that. He's now removed from the scenario, and Justin Steele, great year last year, has to step up and be the number one. What are your expectations of the Cubs starting staff for openers?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. And you know, this is like the biggest challenge a young pitcher like Justin Steele will face, because I've been in this seat. He actually doesn't have to do anything extra. Think about it. He went 16-5 last year. He pitched really well. And sometimes now when we take over that role as the ace, right, the quote-unquote ace of the staff, we feel like we need to do more. And I got to be this extra now. Stroman's gone. He has to just continue. Just do what you've been doing, man. Like, keep going about it the way you're going about it. Make adjustments. The league's going to make adjustments off of you. Find those when you see them happening in real time as quick as possible. But I love the addition of Imanaga. I think he is going to be sneaky good. He's got a lot of swing and miss. He's got deception in his fastball changeup combination. The way his arm action is, it's hard to pick up. When you watch it from behind home plate, it's extremely deceptive. I think he can slide in and put up numbers that were similar to what Stroman had, if not even better. Who knows? You know, staying healthy is always the key. I think the interesting one for me is Kyle Hendricks. You know, here's now coming back healthy now again, you know, and the ability to go out there and pitch like he's capable of pitching healthy, I think, can be a big difference maker. I think it comes down to bullpen. You know, offensively, getting Cody Bellinger back, awesome. I think this is a team that knows how to score runs. They did it last year. Spring training, they don't strike out a lot. They put the ball in play. But I think bullpen wise, who has those years? It's the bullpen is always such a tricky place to try and determine who's going to do what, right? Like you see, oh, this guy had a great year. Is that the off year? Teams love to sign bullpen guys after off years because that means they're going to bounce back and have a good year. So, and who will be closing those games out? You know, I think Alzolay has done an awesome job and really grabbed this closer role by the horns. And I think having Hector Neris in there behind him in case, you know, there's times he needs a blow really helps. I know you think it's a little ambitious. I don't think it's ambitious. I actually think it's a little low, to be honest with you. I see them as somewhere in the 87 to 89 win range. Just when I look at me, but it's a tougher division than people realize. You know, the Central's always had this Pirates at the bottom. Here are the Reds at the bottom. You know, it's Cubs, Cardinals, Brewers. Well, hey, man, Pirates are way better than people realize, you know, and I think they can shock a lot of people come the All-Star break. And the Reds, pitching-wise, I think they're light, but I think offensively they're going to score a ton of runs.
And will the Cubs open against the divisional foe? No, they get the Texas Rangers to start. Leave it to Major League Baseball. You know, I gave them a lot of credit, and you did too, for good changes. You got to get this right. I mean, the Cubs in Texas, it's not like the NFL where you don't want rivals to meet opening week because you only play your divisional opponents twice and nobody works hard in August. You're still finding your way in the NFL in September. It should be Cubs and Brewers or Cubs and Cardinals this weekend. Can't you stuff the suggestion box with the commissioner's office, Demp?
I'm going out to New York in a couple weeks, and it's one of my things on my list. You know, it really is. I look at it this way. There is, I think I looked at 12 games. The Cubs play the Brewers or the Cardinals at the beginning of August. And after that, I think it's either 9 or 12 games within their division in almost 7 weeks. You know, to end the season. So not only are you not playing your rival to start out the season, you're not playing them at the end when it matters. So, now you're relying on other teams. And I just would like to see, and I've heard things that the possibility in 2027 of expansion and, you know, maybe they realign some stuff. I just think, why are you not playing the teams in your division, especially opening the season up and then also at the end of the season? I want all division games. I don't know who the people are. I know it's a couple that make all the schedules that put it all together and have to try and figure out how to mishmash with interleague, you know, all those teams and who you're playing when, and it can't be easy. But there's nothing better than a division rival game down the stretch in September at the end of the season when it's like two games out and you're playing seven games against your division. That is exciting baseball. I don't want to be playing Kansas City on a Tuesday afternoon when they're 30 games back and you're trying to chase down somebody. Meanwhile, the Brewers are playing San Francisco Giants. They're like, what's happening here? How are we not playing our own division? Let's get it going.
I want to hit you on the White Sox, but first, one more thing I'd like to see baseball do better, and people will say you're being gratuitous to your guest, and that's fine. It's the truth, and I've been on this for several years now. You bring, and this probably will sound funny to you, you bring youthful exuberance to Cubs broadcasts when Marquee has you in. I think baseball booths need a hell of a lot more than that. I had the Pirates announcer on my show a few years ago to question him about Steve Blass, his analyst, was bitching about players wearing jewelry and tattoos. You've got guys in their 70s who I remember when they played. You know what? Enough. Get some new voices. Get some guys who played in the 21st century in the booth to get more younger viewers and listeners. I have a feeling I'm speaking your language.
Yeah. Hey, listen, don't get me wrong. There's times where I get on the get off my lawn type of mode when I'm in there, but I try to bite my lip. I think the biggest thing that you have to realize is that, and this is one thing that I feel good about internally knowing is that when I got done playing, they didn't stop playing baseball. They kept playing games the next day, the next season, and then year after year after year. My time was done. I had my time. It's always about that current generation and who's playing. And you mentioned it, like, you know, whether that was, you know, long hair and glasses back in the 70s, or, you know, uniform styles were different in the 80s. And then you go here. it's their game right now. It's not ours. You know, I do wish that some of those dudes who wore all the chains and the nice shoes and they, you know, they got their fancy spikes were hitting over 200, you know, like that would be nice. But at the same time, it's not my place. I just love trying to find things throughout the game and the broadcast that are exciting. They're exciting for the fans. And ultimately, that next generation of kids that's at the ballpark, they're watching those guys. That's their favorite players. So I want to lift them up. I don't want to do anything to bring those guys down. I want to do nothing but pump them up and give baseball the best name it can be. That's the best game in the world, in my opinion. I know there's other ones and other people feel differently. So I want to continue to promote those things rather than point out the things that are what they're fleeting, you know, cool, man, a guy's jersey's untucked a little bit, you know, he doesn't want to run hard around the bases after a home run. Like, and then, you know, that's how it is. Like, that's okay. You know, baseball gods have a way of finding you if you're not doing things the right way and taking care of it on that end. So I love the game. I love how talented these players are. And the more we can just continue to promote that and be excited about that and not what was or what should be, then ultimately we're going to, you know, get more fans. We're going to make it more exciting for the viewer. And that's what it's all about.
I have a double barreled question for you on the White Sox, starting with Michael Kopech. And after 7 years as a starter in the big leagues, you were moved to the bullpen for several years. That's what they're doing with Kopech. They've seen enough of the ups and downs. What's it like to have to check that ego at the door when you get the demotion? And secondly, when you're a member of the White Sox, I don't know if you could relate to this, in a two-team city where you are so clearly the second team and your total on season victories is 61.5. You don't even know what ballpark your team's going to be playing in a few years. How do you continue to have the same zeal to go to work every day in an outfit like the White Sox that is so dysfunctional it can't get out of its own way sometimes?
Yeah, your first, you know, part of that question with Michael Kopech, I think, you know, we've seen this transition a little bit as far as, like, there used to be this thing where it's like you wanted to be a starting pitcher, A, because, you know, being a starting pitcher is awesome. And working once every 5 days is, you know, is pretty sweet. I mean, although you're doing a lot of work on the days in between. And another reason, it was like you didn't get paid if you were a reliever, you know, like there was no guarantees. It was like you could establish yourself as a starter or the closer. The middle guys didn't get anything. And that's changed over time. I mean, we're seeing it now with relievers. You don't even have to be a closer. You can get, you know, secure there. So that kind of has gone away. And two, you know, you have to look in the mirror. I think daily you have to look in the mirror. What am I doing? What can I do better? And I think, you know, you have to sit there and say, okay, like, oh, I'm a starter, but are you? You know, like, it's been a struggle, right? Year after year, struggle either staying healthy, struggle getting out second time through the lineup, third time through the lineup. And so maybe you find something in there where it clicks for you and you can become elite. I've seen that with lots of guys too. Like for me, I went to the bullpen kind of out of necessity coming back from Tommy John surgery. And then, you know, I actually went starter to reliever, back to starter to closer, back to starter again. Cause in 05, I started 6 games and then we needed a closer. And I always view it like this. When you sign a contract with a team and you get paid, which I was under contract, so I was getting paid. I try to do whatever I can to help the team win. So if the team's coming to me and saying, this is what we feel is important, then ultimately, if you do that, you're going to get taken care of. Like, if you win a World Series as a team, almost every guy on that team gets picked up by somebody. They get a long-term deal with somebody. That's just how it works because winning breeds that. So if you take that attitude and dominate it, you're going to find yourself in the right position after that. Now, that being said, you're in a place where you're struggling as a franchise right now to win ball games. And you have to stay motivated. And that goes for each and every guy in that locker room. There was always a saying we got taught is you're not just playing for your own team. You're playing for the 29 other teams that are sending scouts there to watch you. You know, you're playing for those fans that pay tickets, pay the price of a ticket to come watch you play. You have to go out there and give your best. And so if times are tough, you got to continue even more so. Anybody can be great when things are good, as far as an attitude, a work ethic. How are you when those times are tough? How do you go out there and show everybody that you can be a leader? How can you lead the next group of pitchers that come through, or next group of position players? How do I bust my butt down the line every time when there's a ground ball to shortstop or a ball in the gap that I'm thinking three and not two? You know, how can I score for my teammate on a ground ball to right field and I'm on second base and I make sure I score? You know, like, there's all these things that everybody else is watching, and you can easily get trapped when you're struggling as a team. And then now teams around the league start to view you as that type of player that doesn't care. He's a dog. He doesn't run hard and all those kind of things. So, and that's hard when you're going through this, and you're going through it year after year with a team that, you know, is not winning. And then on top of it, you play second fiddle to a team on the north side that everybody in Chicago quote unquote loves, you know, and use that as fuel. I don't know, find a way to dig down deep and use that as fuel. Because it's going to be a little bit of a struggle, in, you know, for the White Sox for a little while, and they're going to have to figure out how to right the ship and get back to they were in those early 2000s, late, you know, the 90s into the 2000s when they won a World Series, because that was fun. There was nothing more fun than when the White Sox were good and the Cubs were good, man. I couldn't wait to ride my bike down to the South Side and go play the White Sox, I couldn't wait till they got up here. So that's what we want in the city of Chicago, is both teams to be good.
And the Sox have won two postseason games since that 0-5 World Series, whether they needed to or not. Demp, lots of fun catching up. I got you down for 87-89 Cubs victories this year. And it's really fun talking music with you and talking baseball as well. Have a great season, and hopefully we can do this again down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Danny. I appreciate it, man.
That's Ryan Dempster, former Cubs right-hander. You can follow him on Twitter at Dempster46. Thanking Randy Merkin, who handles all of the guest load for the podcast. Brian Urlacher getting big box office over the weekend. Thank you for those of you who are new subscribers on YouTube. The executive producer of the show is Sam Michael. Adam Delavitt and Troy Mocker. Shane in Cleveland, thank you for your help as well. Talk to you later in the week. I'm Dan McNeil.
Thanks for listening to the Danny Mac Podcast on the BetRivers Network.